Geekily Yoked is a proud member of the Crossover Nexus. To find more blogs and podcasts about the intersection of faith and pop culture, check out crossovernexus.com. Tell them Bilbo sent you.
So many ways to say I love you in different languages across the land. You haven't heard them all, so I'll tell you as only a true geek can.
Hello and welcome to Geekily Yoked, the world's best married Christian geek podcast. As always, I'm Lehman Kessler.
And I'm Rachel Kessler.
That's Mother Rachel Kessler.
I'm a priest here in the Anglican Diocese of Toronto with a PhD in medieval literature that makes me a giant nerd.
And all this week, I've been getting inside of a tent and pretending to be H.P. Lovecraft, which makes me a giant dork.
It's true.
We are both in the midst of fun, exciting new projects.
Although yours is coming to a close.
It's very true. So by the time this comes out, I think there'll be about a day or two left of the Ask Lovecraft at the Toronto Fringe, where you can come out and see me live as H.P. Lovecraft, doing a sort of little spiel and bit of comedy every now and then.
It's really hard to explain to people. It's really hard. It's really, really good, and everyone who comes really enjoys it, but it's so hard to explain to people.
I'm explaining it as an intimate encounter with H.P. Lovecraft, the grandfather of modern horror. Essentially, it's based on some live shows I've done before where I just do question and answers with audience members, so it's just a sort of improvised, you know, answers and sort of off-the-cuff responses. But we didn't want to assume that people at the Fringe actually knew who Lovecraft was or would want to ask him questions. So we sort of went through and kind of cobbled together a sort of top 10 list of questions that I've rehearsed and have prepared responses for, and I kind of read through those. And then I do a live response to folks, which has been, I think, kind of the highlight. That's the stuff folks really seem to enjoy. And yeah, it's been a fun experience, and I'm sad to see it come to its end, but as it's ending, another project is starting up, which is Rachel's new blog!
Yeah! I'm blogging Farscape.
And why shouldn't you?
Because it's crazy!
Well, it's Farscape.
Yes, so that is thematically appropriate. But this was entirely your idea. I blame you.
Well, you know what? You look like you were needing more things to do.
I don't think I needed more things to do. I just needed something that was a creative outlet.
Yes.
That was really, I think, I needed a project that wasn't keeping a small human being alive or caring for people's eternal souls.
Both of which do have hardships. So what is this new blog going to look like? Sadly, I don't think it's just going to be an episode-by-episode description, which is what I would like to see, because that would be maximum obsession.
But why?
I don't know, craziness?
No, it's just I'm going to rewatch Farscape and then journal my thoughts as we go along. It'll be a lot of why Aaron's son is the best.
How many number of times will this make you going through Farscape? I understand every now and then you'll just sort of, like, rewatch specific episodes.
It's true. Well, I guess I watched the first time. Then I watched through it systematically with Alice and Cheryl.
Yes.
Our friends. And then I watched it again when Amanda was first born. So I guess it'll be the fourth just genuine sit down and systematically watch through all of the episodes in an ordered manner.
In about 1 year, will that make it?
No, it was like 2 or 3 years.
I am suspicious.
I discovered Farscape before we started this podcast.
Okay. I'm going to have to go back and see what the record shows.
Admittedly, I'm fair. Like, it is not a long-standing love, my fixation
passion
on Farscape. The intensity of it would belie the relatively short period that I have known it.
I consider you still an adult convert to
Farscape. I think that's fair. That's fair. Adult. That convert zeal is certainly something I have.
Well, and it helps there. That it's frozen in amber, right? Like, it's not going to get worse.
Except,
you know?
They're making a movie.
Oh, right. I forgot.
Sometime in the future. But they're writing one.
Well, in the midst of your Farscape rewatch, we've started watching something else, which has been a lot of fun.
Brooklyn Nine-Nine!
We discovered Brooklyn Nine-Nine. I had been hearing about it on various podcasts and whatnot, and I finally saw it was on Netflix, and I said, hey, Rachel, we should watch it. And what was your response?
I don't want to watch something you're suggesting.
You thought it was like some,
Well, I thought it was going to be a lame cop show.
Ye of Little Faith. This is like Amelie all over again.
It is like Amelie all over again.
Amelie? Now on DVD?
I think that's probably my problem with, like, with even Farscape. See, like, I'm like a cat. I have to discover things on my own, and when people try to get me to watch something, I'm just like, I don't want to do that.
I mean, did it help that I had started watching Farscape and it got sort of sick of it?
I thought we were watching it at the same time originally.
I think I watched the first episode or two by myself.
Oh, okay. And you were just kind of like, eh.
The one where he was unstuck in time.
You really hated that one, man.
I hated that one so much. It was so dumb. And the evil female alien was just...
Yeah, I basically wrote off like the 5 episodes between the premiere and PK Tech Girl when the series actually starts getting good. I think I covered them all in one post.
I was enjoying seeing on Facebook the back and forth and Van making fun of Farscape until I started pointing out some of the troubles in going back to rewatch season 1 of Next Generation.
Anyway, we have been watching Brooklyn Nine-Nine, and it is utterly delightful. I have not laughed this much in a sitcom in a long time.
It makes me really wish we Canadians got Parks and Recreation.
I know, we need to watch Parks and Recreation.
But this has been wonderful. I wasn't sure what to expect from it. I'd heard that it was really funny.
It's a happy sitcom.
It's very happy.
It's a sitcom where everyone is just likable, and you root for them, and...
And even if they are strange and antisocial...
They're quirky, but they're not...
No one is particularly misanthropic, or at
exactly,
least...
Exactly, exactly.
If they are, it's very lightly done. There's not that... It's not mean, right? We're sort of getting out of that... The sort of the mean sitcom, which prevailed for a while, which... You know what? I'll confess, I enjoyed. I like Arrested Development. I think it could be a mean sitcom.
It's true.
I definitely like shows like Archer or It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia, which again, rely on sort of terrible people. This is not so much watching terrible people, but watching delightful people.
Just be wonderful and goofy and...
But not too schmaltzy either.
But it's not, you know, it's totally not schmaltzy. Like, it somehow manages to not be, this will bring us into our theme for today, it manages to not be like 90s earnestness.
No.
It still seems to have that like post 2000s ironic detachment.
Yes.
Without being mean.
And it's also not particularly self-aware.
It's true.
Being a cop show, I think they could have very easily played with like the tropes of like police stuff, and they've come close.
But they haven't really at all.
But it's not super lampshaded. It's very much, I mean, I think if you
look, you gotta kind of get the impression that these are actually really good cops. Like, in that sense, it's not a deconstruction of cops or cop genre.
No.
Because these, you get the impression that, with the exception of the guys in the office who are just clearly buffoons,
yes,
the central characters, you get the impression that they have integrity and they're cops for a good reason and that they're actually good at their job.
Well, and someone was pointing out, it's just starts off strong and stays there.
Yeah.
Parks and Recreation, people sort of critiqued its first season because it was trying a bit too hard to kind of be like The Office.
Yeah.
And it took them like, you know, the first season I watched through and thought it was all right. But as soon as I started watching the second season, I was like, oh, okay, now I get it.
Right.
Like they really, I mean, The Office as well had that where they were sort of aping the British style. And then by the time they started getting to the second and third season, they had become their own thing. And I think you can certainly see a lot of parallels, like a lot of the tropes are very similar. They're sort of the slumpy, kind of out of shape, you know, bad office workers.
Yeah.
You know, or cops or, you know, city councilors, however you want to look at it. But it's really just delightful. And I want to say a lot of folks from Parks and Recreation.
I think you're right.
Worked on this as well. But this does launch us into our discussion. We've talked about it before, I want to say in our 90s episode.
Okay, but I don't think we've done a whole episode on this topic.
We haven't, no, we haven't. And that's the idea of the do-gooder.
Yeah.
The do-gooder show. And this may be a genre that I
have invented. We have just made up.
Or that has come about in our various discussions. But over time, I began to, at some point, we noticed that there was an absence of a type of show that I felt was very specific. And it was a part of my childhood and adolescence, and I certainly remember from the 90s. But then I realized actually can be traced back further into the past, but really we haven't seen since the end of the 90s. Or maybe. We're going to kind of touch base on that. And that's the idea of this do-gooder show. A lot of shows are about solving a problem or helping people out, but there was this specific kind of show. I feel like it was represented by shows like The Pretender.
Mm.
Or...
Well, The Incredible Hulk.
Well, yeah, The Incredible Hulk, The Fugitive, Time Tracks, Kung
Fu... The Littlest Hobo.
The Littlest Hobo, Kung Fu, The Legend Continues. And it's in its purest form, we'll sort of look at, you know, grades of it. It's about a sort of itinerant hero who goes from town to town. He's either on the run for something or, for whatever reason, can't stay in any particular location. And is incredibly earnest, incredibly good at what he does, you know, solves his problem and moves on. And I think big examples in the 90s would be Hercules.
Mm.
You know, Hercules was a big part of
early edition.
Yes. Now we're starting to move out of the purer form. Since I invented this genre, I feel like I get to define it. So I feel at the core you have the itinerant lone hero.
Okay, let's go back to where you think this began and trace it historically.
Historically, it probably, and I haven't watched them, but it probably comes from old cowboy shows.
Okay.
You know, this idea of there being, you know, a town where there's trouble or a mine where, you know, folks have taken it over and this cowboy sort of comes in.
Does Lassie count as a do-gooder show?
Well, again, Lassie is linked to that specific farm. Okay. And so there's, you know, we'll talk about the gradations of it. But I think the itinerant hero who comes in, solves a problem, and then moves on. It works incredibly well for episodic television. And it's different, I would say, from a show like Star Trek, which is a more ensemble show. I feel like a lot of these do-gooder shows, while they may have had a recurring cast, were really about a kind of core, you know, very, like a core character that you followed, and that this was the person you were meant to, you know, sympathize with and figure out, you know.
Okay, so it begins with Westerns.
With Westerns, Cowboys. and then you get shows like The Fugitive and The Incredible Hulk. You know, shows where you have this sympathetic character who's, you know, mildly tragic.
Okay.
And is going, you know, solving...
Because they can never truly be part of any community for some reason.
Yeah, precisely. You know, it's not they're being sent on missions. That's an... I think there's that type of show. You know, like the Wild Wild West or kind of, you know, Mission like Impossible. A-Team, yeah. I mean, A-Team again is this very ensemble piece. You get to shows like Time Tracks or the Pretender. The Pretender really is where I think because this is the show.
Okay,
I
actually don't know The Pretender at all, so you're going to have to fill me in on this.
So The Pretender was this incredibly 90s show. It had everything. It had, like, corporate angst. It had weird, like, governmental conspiracies. The idea was this, like, sinister organization took gifted children and raised them and trained them to carry out covert missions.
Okay.
And their most brilliant child was this kid named Jared, and he was just brilliant. He was able to, like, just work, you know, put his mind into anyone's place. Super sympathetic, a sort of better adjusted Will Graham.
Okay.
You know, he could just, and the big thing he could do was he could very quickly realize how to fake any situation, you know, so he could go into a hospital and figure out the jargon and figure out how to fake being a doctor and just learn incredibly fast. Okay. Then, as an adult, he discovers that this organization is actually doing, like, evil, covert black ops and, you know, is staging assassinations and coups and things and doing, you know, all sorts of evil corporate stuff. So he escapes.
Okay.
And so the shows were incredibly formulaic. It would be, he would come to a new location, he would learn something new about pop culture or, like, about life outside of this institution, like, he would learn what a yo-yo was, or what ice cream was. You know, he would become the town lawyer, or, you know, become the deputy sheriff, or go to work in the mayor's office, and people would just sort of accept him because he was really good at faking his way into these locations.
Right.
And there would be some problem. There'd been a murder, or there was an embezzlement, and, you know, and or someone was being blackmailed, and he would solve that problem. Usually there would always be like a main bad guy and a secondary bad guy, and he would sort of suborn the secondary bad guy into turning on the main bad guy and set up like weird kind of Rube Goldberg machines. But that was only part of the narrative. The second part was about this institution tracking him down.
Okay.
Because he was this very important investment and they needed him back and he knew all these secrets and so they were chasing him. And so...
So did Joss Whedon just totally steal that for Firefly 2?
Maybe.
Dude, the man is a hack.
but I guess in a weird way you could call it an ensemble show because that was the ensemble. Like, his trainer, played by Patrick Bausch, who was really weird because he really cared for Jared and wanted Jared back, but was also helping to hunt him down, but would also kind of tip Jared off if he felt like the people hunting after him didn't mean him well. And there was just this whole kind of team chasing after him, and he would always get away right at the last minute and usually use this pop cultural device to taunt them. So, like, they'd find that room he was meant to be in, and there'd be an ice cream cone waiting, or, like, a yo-yo would, like, smack someone in the face. Again, ridiculously formulaic, super episodic. After a while, they began to, like, piece together a bit of a long-form narrative, and, like, the conspiracy was sort of breaking down, and you found out weird things about clones, and I stopped watching after that point. So that was Pretender specifically. And again, that's this itinerant hero show. But I think, you know, Hercules was another good example. You know, he was a guy going from place to place to place, you know, never particularly, you know, not really going on any missions, you know, just yeah. Like he would arrive in a town and Ares had been there and messed things up. So he had to go chase down Ares. Or Xena had been villainous and as they were setting her up for her own TV show. And then Time Tracks was another one. This was a ridiculous show. Probably filmed, if not in Toronto, then in, like, British Columbia. But it was about a time-traveling police officer who, you know, was sent back to the present from the future because in the future, an evil criminal had sent all these terrible criminals into the past to escape justice, and now he had to go back into the past. But time travel can only work twice, and if you time travel more than that, then you die. So, like, he has to round all of them up before he can go back to the future, and it was bizarre. But again, going from place to place, solving these, you know, sort of crimes, helping people out, you know, tracking down these criminals. Highlander, again, Highlander, because it was set in one place, I'm going to move to the secondary tier of do-gooder,
Move on to a secondary tier, we have to mention Quantum Leap.
And, yes, okay, Quantum Leap. Quantum Leap is, you know, moving from place to place, solving problems. Knight Rider, I think, would also kind of figure into this. I never watched Highway to Heaven.
I have to say, like, I've never seen you as enthusiastic on this podcast as this episode.
Well, I've never heard people really talk in depth about this. And it's something that's always been in my head, this specific show, and what it means that we don't have so much of it anymore.
All right.
Like, what, you know, because it was such an episodic and such a, I think, you know, you can point at shows like it. There's probably tons that I'm missing. And it's also, you know, I think it's something probably people don't talk about because it's sort of a genre, a niche genre I've invented in my own head.
But I think you're right. It clearly seems to exist.
Yes.
So what happens when do we lose that itinerant hero? Because we do move, there's still do-gooder shows, particularly in the late 90s.
Yes.
Where you have the Mountie, which we have talked about before.
Yes.
You know, this strange, Canadian Mountie attached, Ernest Mountie attached to the Canadian consulate, who is ostensibly in the States, like, looking for his father's murderer, which he solves in the pilot episode and then just kind of hangs around.
Yes.
But it is a do-gooder show. Like, he's always helping the downtrodden.
Precisely.
He's not necessarily just helping his buddy Ray out on actual detective cases.
Yes.
Like, it actually kind of gets to be a joke that he gets known as, like, people come seeking him out because they know that he will help them.
Well, and this moves us into this next...
And then I'm thinking about, like, Lois and Clark,
yes.
Superman show. I mean, he was the do-gooder of do-gooders.
Yeah.
I mean, he was the epitome of this, like, 90s earnest hero, but not itinerant.
Well, and you
even Buffy the Vampire Slayer, Angel,
yes.
You can
see
falling into that, like, kind of...
Well, again, there's definitely hero shows. Like, hero shows have been around, and cop shows have been around.
Yeah.
You know, these, you know, serve and protect kind of things. You know, Smallville was a thing. Even the Adventures of Superboy, you know, was around. Or, you know, the variations of Batman. But I feel like they somehow fall out of this kind of do-gooder quality.
Because they have no... the whole point of this itinerant hero that you're talking about is that they don't have a place that is their own, and their whole existence is just wandering, and in their meanderings, they manage to do good.
Yeah, and there's sort of this, like, knight-errant quality about them. There's this, again, I think because it probably, you know...
I just need to lampshade the fact that this is incredibly dude-heavy.
It's very dude-heavy.
Let's just lay that out there.
Yeah, no, ladies can't help folks. we can do a whole lady chains thing about this. Well, part of it is that it's such an older style, right?
Yeah.
You know, by the time we're getting into Buffy the Vampire Slayer, it's about defending her community. It's about, you know, defending her high school. And it's becoming an ensemble show, you know? I don't know what it is.
But I'm also, like, I have to say that I'm really impressed with, even more impressed with Buffy talking about this, because she is one of the first, like, do-gooding female heroes.
There was Wonder Woman, Isis.
Well, I was thinking Wonder Woman, Xena, and the Bionic Woman.
Yes.
I guess. Like, I mean, it's a pretty thin
yeah.
pretty shallow pool to be drawing from.
Oh yeah, definitely. So that's for me. I feel like that's the platonic form of this sort of do-gooder. There's two secondary tiers. One is the sort of the stationary do-gooder show, which is something like Early Edition, where you've got someone who's got like a special power who is using it to help his city, and you begin to have a bit more of an ensemble because you're in the same area. You know, so you've got like your friend, you know, and the bartender that you always go to. And I guess
having that ensemble makes them less of a tragic character.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. They're like, I mean, Early Edition did a great job of highlighting like the weird position this guy was in and sort of how his life was falling apart. So like I consider Early Edition to really be on the cusp of this, you know, sort of do-gooderiness.
And now we get to see him as Coach Taylor.
And well, we, I guess, saw him as Coach Taylor because I don't think it's on anymore.
I guess.
I guess in the weird way that everything is on Netflix and sort of, you know, perpetuity until it's taken off. And it also, it's a type of show that doesn't have any particular, you know, for the most part, doesn't, you know, avoid sort of meta plot because it's this, you know, every adventure is a new town, a new place.
Yeah.
But that, you know, that as well kind of breaks down. I mentioned even The Pretender, they sort of started to bring in more of a plot. Hercules began to have this very strange sort of, you know, long-form plot dealing with Aeolus getting possessed by Satan and things like that. And then...
So what's the other subgenre?
Well, the more ensemble version of this, you know, where we've seen... where you have, you know, a team going about and, you know, going from place to place to place. Because in...
Sliders,
I think, would be an example of that.
Right.
You know, you've got this group, you know, Stargate maybe to some degree. Would I call it Fargate?
You called it Fargate.
I did call it Fargate. Although, isn't that what the...
I win!
Isn't that what these people call, like, the...
It is the people who are fans of both Farscape and Stargate are Fargators.
Fargators, okay.
It's true.
I knew
it's
I had that
in my
head
It's a sad world
somewhere.
That we live in, Lehman. Our glorious world, depending on your perspective. But yeah, you just used the word Fargate.
I did just use the Fargate. Because here's the thing. Like, let's look
But Stargate, I think you're right. SG-1 is that, it's that itinerancy, but it's team-based.
It's team-based, it's mission-based, which is also a little different, you know, like they're being sent out. And that's why I feel like cop shows don't quite fit that same bill. I mean, with Brooklyn Nine-Nine, I mean, it's a sitcom. I think that's what it is primarily. And the sort of the crime stuff that comes up is really just their...
But there's a Robin Hood aspect to this, the itinerant.
Being outside the system. There's one show I can't even remember its name. Again, weird show from the 90s. It was a guy sort of on the run. I think his like ex-wife was chasing after him, but he was like trying to prove they didn't do this murder. So he was, you know, trying, but it was all very tongue-in-cheek, and every now and then he would like run into Elvis. Very 90s.
Are you sure you didn't dream this?
I did not dream this. This was an actual show. I'll see if I can find it and put it
the
in show notes.
The 90s was such a strange time.
And you know, Highlander. You know, Highlander was this, you know, every episode there's some, you know, evil guy that he has to kind of track down. And that's, again, more stationary.
All right, so let's figure out what the last instance of that show, that genre, was.
Personally, I feel, if we're looking at a kind of that itinerant hero going from place to place to place, I almost feel like it is Hercules.
Yeah, okay.
You know, Hercules, and again, it breaks down a little bit, but I think Hercules and Xena kind of had that quality.
Okay.
You know, you had a new place, you had a new adventure every week, you know, you got to explore some aspect, you know, there was, with her, or especially early Hercules, really played up the tragedy of his being driven insane and killing his wife. I think they sort of began to pull away from that a little bit. Although then they started having him travel to like other mythologies and like go to Ireland.
Yeah, then it just got weird.
And hang out with Gilgamesh and things like that. So there's that traveling aspect to the sort of the pure form. There's that, you know, sort of being hunted aspect. Again, with him, he was being hunted by Hera. So, and really, it's a tone thing, you know? I think it's one of those like how you recognize art. You know, you just know it when you see it. And there's an earnestness. There's a weird, even in the midst of tragedy, there's a kind of optimism to it. You know, the Pretender went to very dark places, but he was always incredibly sort of upbeat, positive, and, you know, and could roll with the punches. And you knew every week he was going to get out of the scrape, and you knew every week he was going to, you know, get one step ahead of the people chasing after him.
So would you say it's the evolution of more serialized storytelling that led to this?
I think so, yeah.
Or a combination of serialized storytelling and a somewhat more not to go into the post 9/11 world, but a darker cultural
milieu.
Yeah,
I think so. Actually, what just struck and like came into my head. I don't know if this lasted more than a season, but there was a show called The Lazarus Man.
Okay,
and it was a cowboy show, and it was sort of this itinerant. Sort of, you know, do-gooder, you know, he was going from place to place. I can't remember who the main actor was. Someone like, you know, Robert Wagner or Robert Urich or something like that. But the idea was he had been on Lincoln's security detail the night of his assassination. He had been, like, pulled aside, shot, and, like, so it was like he had, like, stumbled into some major, you know, the conspiracy to kill Lincoln. He'd been shot and put into an unmarked grave and left for dead. And then he rises from it with no memory of who he is. And is sort of trying to piece together the details of his life and this conspiracy. So it had that slightly X-Files-y, there's like some conspiracy at work, or Millennium. You know, these were, you know, shows that were, you know, there was this, that 90s like, you know, I've got to piece together the puzzle sort of thing. But at the same time, he was sort of going from place to place, you know, doing good, even though he had no real memory of who he was, but having these skills, a kind of, you know, Western Jason Bourne kind of show. So if I could go back and find that, that would probably be one of the last ones. And again, I don't think it lasted more than a season or two. Because, yeah, as you start getting into more long-form shows, as you start getting, you know, Buffy, you know, began to very quickly move away from Monster of the Week.
Well, and I think as viewers began to demand greater complexity.
Yeah.
I mean, I think it can be traced back to our general, like, our discomfort with heroes.
Yeah.
I mean, you could see that in the Lord of the Rings movies. We can't let Aragorn be anything but the reluctant hero.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Right? We don't want him ready and willing to take on his place as the King of Gondor. Because that's bad.
Well, obviously. That's not, you know, it comes to kingdoms. I don't think any of us are particularly comfortable with,
But I'm just saying, like, we have this discomfort with unambiguously good and unambiguously evil people.
It's very true. And the sort of the tragic hero is different, right? And the sort of the plagued hero, the chaste hero. I mean, I think there's chaste, S-E-D, although I guess S-T-E would be something as well. But it's an interest. I think that's a big part. I think losing the sort of assumed episodic nature of television, so it becomes harder to sort of pitch. Well, he just goes from place to place and solves problems because why not? And that reluctance for just sort of pure optimistic heroes. I think the rise of the ensemble show. You know, I think that, you know, that's a big part of it. And what I've been trying to do as, you know, thinking about this episode is figure out where in modern television I've seen at least traces of this. You know, if this is a type of TV show that really existed from, like, you know, the 60s to the 90s.
Right.
You know, where did it wind up? You know, do we still see pieces of this? And only really two shows spring to mind in any way. One is Leverage.
Leverage. That is the... I just have this theory that those TNT dramas are the most stealthy, geeky shows on television. Because you look at Leverage and Suits.
Yes.
They're just... They're full of, like, geeky in-jokes. There's an episode of Leverage that is directed by Jonathan Frakes and stars...
Brent Spiner, yeah.
Like, it's insane.
Oh, yeah.
There's an episode that has... Because, like... Lindsay from Angel is on it, and there's an episode that has Holland Manners.
Oh, right.
And I forget what it is, but they do something on screen that's like a little Wolfram and Hart
throwback.
Like throwback, and it's just insane.
Yeah. Well, Leverage has, it's the ensemble show, so it's that, again, you know, moving through my various, like, tiers that on my crazy map that I have etched out. You know, it's that second layer, but it's an ensemble show where they are very much, you know, solving a problem. And it's just, the way they go about it is so earnest and is so very episodic.
I forget that show is not from the 90s, from the 90s. When I watch it.
I think it's why you were so quick to want to list, you know, Adventures of Lois and Clark.
Yeah.
You know, because it had that, like, bright, splashy, you know, optimistic, just...
So, for those of you out here, if you're not familiar with Leverage, it isn't... I mean, we haven't watched it. I think that's the problem with these episodic shows is it's hard to just sit down and, like, commit to watching five seasons of it.
Well, we're so used to binging.
we're used to binging, but it's a lot harder to binge a really formulaic episodic show.
Yeah. Well, they're made to be once per week.
Exactly. But it's this idea of, like, this collection of criminals who basically in the premiere episode makes so much money off of their first, like, this big heist they pull off to kind of stick it to the insurance company. That,
well, they're all being drawn in like it's a trap, and they sort of like flip the trap.
Yeah.
And in so doing, make like millions of dollars. So like they're set for life.
Yeah. So basically they're set for life, but they just like doing crime so much that they've started taking on this like Robin Hood element where they rob the rich to help the downtrodden and the poor, basically.
Well, it's
for kicks.
Well, and just that the writers managed to find the like the most ridiculously sort of maudlin situations. Like there's like an insurance company is screwing over like a wounded veteran.
Yeah.
You know, like there's like Russian orphans that are being mistreated. It is so, so schmaltzy because it's essentially Ocean's 11, the TV show. You know, they've got the guy who's really good at weapons. You've got the guy who's the really good hacker. The guy who can, like, you know, do the best impersonations of people and, like, you know.
The grifter.
There's the grifter and stuff like that.
Who's actually a really, really terrible actress in real life.
Yes.
Not that, like, the actress is fine. Her character is a terrible actress, except when she's
theatrical. Yes, acting. And so every episode, they gotta figure out, you know, how they're going to con these people. Then things go wrong. But oops, no, they had a counter, you know, plan for that. And it, like, plays the do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do. Like, it plays the Ocean's 11 music the entire time. And it's, you know, it's fun. It's, you know, it's thoughtless. It's just like, oh, that was a fun, you know, time, you know, of watching. And so I feel like that has that earnestness, that repeated quality, that, like, you know, it's super predictability. Oh, another show I wanted to kind of mention as far as that kind of second tier was The Commish. Because The Commish was a cop show starring Michael Chiklis, who I believe plays The Thing now in the various Fantastic Four movies. And he was on The Shield, which was like a sort of gritty cop show. But I always knew him as the dumpy guy, the dumpy commissioner from The Commish. And that was, again, more cop-based, but he was this sort of, you know, overworked and kind of slightly tragic hero, but who always, like, did the good thing and the right thing and was super episodic and super repetitive. Very much like
really need to see the, like, body language Lehman has going into this episode. It's very impressive.
Well, you know, I'm trying to figure out, like, why, like, a Matlock wouldn't be considered a do-gooder show.
Now I suddenly understand why our daughter is gesticulating so wildly all the time.
Murder, She Wrote actually might come pretty close, especially when she travels from place to place.
I just kind of like how you're talking past my attempts to mock you.
Well, you know what? We all have coping mechanisms, Rachel. So... no, Murder, She Wrote is very much, I think, and Matlock, they're very much in that murder mystery.
Oh, look, and there's a lady.
There you go. There's the one. but yeah, so Leverage has all of those elements. Again, there is a bit of tragedy, you know, because there's sort of the mysterious past of some of the folks, you know, working in it. But yeah, it's own sort of weird thing. The other one, strangely enough, is Suits.
Seriously?
Specifically the young lawyer in Suits. Like, if the show were just about him, like, this would, it would have so much of that DNA because he is incredibly earnest. He is sort of like, you know, has this past that's waiting to haunt him, like, could come and bite him at any moment. The way he solves his cases is always incredibly sort of, like, schmaltzy and, like, last minute.
I suppose that's true.
And just his components
are have a superpower.
He does have superpowers. And, yeah, so his part of the show is, I feel, very... It has that earnestness, has that kind of optimism. The rest of the show, which is like the weird, like, Machiavellian power struggles within a law firm, or like the cases that the main lawyer does, which is like, you sort of think about it, it's like, oh, it's just sort of one billionaire not having to pay another billionaire so much money. But we're invested because we just want him to win. So he has that great track record. Those are the shows I feel have managed to maintain some of this. You know, Firefly, I think we looked at, you know, has a little bit of that, you know, chase going from place to place.
Yeah, but they're not really do-gooders.
But,
well... Not really. No. I mean, like, there is as many episodes in Firefly are about them just trying to get by.
That's fair.
I can't actually think of a single episode of Firefly that's really a do... Like, the only episode where they...
The train robbery?
Well, yeah, that's the only episode I can think of. And that's not like they're going out to try to help people as much as... They decide not to do something to actively hurt them.
They wanted to help
out of sympathy.
They wanted to help the Mudders.
No, but they didn't.
Oh, they didn't? Oh.
They didn't at all. Okay. Jane accidentally helped the Mudders, and they just try to get out without, like, causing more damage.
Never mind then.
There's nothing do-goodery about Firefly.
They are just villains.
And I think it'd be interesting. I would want to see what Angel was if it had been made 10 years earlier.
That's true.
I mean,
yeah.
The character of Angel is set up to be an itinerant.
Oh, yeah.
It's, I mean, kind of one of the running themes of that show is that he is only saved by the fact that he has these people who care about him.
Oh, yeah.
And kind of keep, but I mean, you could have seen, there could be have been a whole series about Angel before he got,
like, before he wound up in
Sunnydale?
When he was just going to Barry Manilow concerts?
Yeah, when he was just going to Barry Manilow concerts and eating rats, right? I mean, like, you could have... That could have gone one of two ways. It could have gone that Whistler found him and took him to like, clean him up so he could be a help to Buffy.
Yeah.
Or he could have... Like, something could have happened and he would have become this itinerant do-gooder.
No, that's very true.
So
that's sort of the state of things. I mean, this is a, you know, a half-formed thesis I've kind of been putting together. But I do feel like there was this through line that has shattered or mutated.
Here's a question, though. Do you think that, I mean, the 2000s
yes.
were a very pessimistic decade?
Oh, yeah.
For many geopolitical reasons.
Sure.
And I think that is seen in the television and in the popular culture. And this is, we're particularly talking about TV here. So I think you see that in Battlestar Galactica, certainly.
Oh, yeah.
You see it to a certain degree in Fringe. Are we coming out of that? Do we see, like, I mean, and as you say, even the comedies in the 2000s were really mean comedies.
Oh, yeah.
Are we coming out of that? Are we maybe possibly moving in once again to a somewhat more, like, where we're just so tired of being so
gloomy,
gloomy and ironically detached all the time.
Sort of, you know, 70s going into 80s, going into 90s, that kind of, like, yeah. Reversal. I don't know, maybe. Well, you know, it's a question of where TV is headed right now. I mean, I think the fact that Game of Thrones is so popular suggests maybe not.
Fair enough. Fair enough.
But then, you know, you've got shows like Orange is the New Black, making sure I'm not saying Orphan.
which is strangely heartwarming.
Yeah, sort of chipper for all of its kind of grimness.
Yeah.
But again, it's, you know, I feel like a show like this we're probably not going to see again. That kind of, like, paladinic show.
Right.
You know, like, you know, the do-gooder version of this would be like, The Adventures of Ned Stark,
brought in Doctor Who? I mean, where... I feel like it needs to be addressed.
In the same way of space opera?
Well, yeah, but I mean, like, on some level, it bears some resemblance to this genre.
No, that's actually very fair, and I haven't watched enough new Who to really say one way or the other, but I mean, yeah, I guess he does go from place to place. He does have the haunted past. He does have, like, you know, it's a bit of an ensemble, but it's a small ensemble.
I mean, I think one of the things you get with Doctor Who that complicates this is that idea of his presence causes as many problems as he solves, right?
Well, yes.
No, I mean, it's one of the darker themes that runs through Doctor Who is that he brings death in his wake.
Yeah.
And so as much as he is a traveling do-gooder on some level... It's almost seen as that there is this fatalistic sense that he brings the trouble with him.
But I mean, that's, I think, the same thing we'd see with the Incredible Hulk, right?
Mm.
Or with the Pretender, you know,
yeah.
Like they are trailing this, you know, sort of darkness behind them. So maybe, you know, and maybe it was something that was kind of, you know, it's been around for a very long time, right? It's got that pedigree. You know, I think it probably, if we looked at Doctor Who.
The Knight Errants, let's just go back to that again.
Yeah, well, if we look at Doctor Who, you know, prior to its reboot, it probably is closer to what I think of when I think of these sort of, you know, itinerant do-gooder shows. For whatever reason, the post-relaunch era feels a little differently to me. I don't know why. I don't know why that is. I just, for some reason, it doesn't strike me the same way. I don't know if it is, just has a lot of that 2000 kind of grimness and snark to it. But I think that might be the thing to explore. And this is actually something we'd love to hear from you guys about, and comments and whatnot. You know, what do you think? Is this a genre that's sort of come and gone? Did it ever really exist, or is it only in my sort of mad, feverish imagination that I've cobbled together this type of show? Because I do feel like there is this through line, but maybe it's just, you know, something I've shot up the barn and I've put my target, you know, around the holes to make it look like I've found this interesting connection. But if there's shows you can think of, let us know, because we'd love to hear and find out if there's actually something to this. And whether there's current shows going on that match this.
I'm going to go watch some more Farscape. Write my little blog.
That's what you do.
Get to talk about Aaron's son as much as I want to.
Aaron's son.
His greatest character. Science fiction.
I guess.
That's all I got.
That's all we got. That'll be it for this week. Look forward to, we're going to be doing more stuff with the Crossover Nexus.
We are.
Hopefully there'll be another roundtable. If you haven't heard, Rachel's on the last roundtable talking about monsters.
She totally should not have been on that episode.
Well,
I was just like, I want to play. It'd be fun. I don't know anything about monsters.
Man is the real monster.
We didn't really get to that, actually.
What? But, this is what happens when I walk away. So we've got that coming up. There'll be more crossover events, and that's really it from us. I think I'll figure out some fun do-goodery Debs and Errol song to play at the end of this. Maybe Timmy the Combat Wombat.
I got nothing it's more pretty than apt. That. Does he like to curl up in a ball?
We do not need to cite our children's storybooks to these
Sometimes
people.
Sometimes I like to curl up in a ball so no one can see me because I'm so small. Sometimes I like to stand as still as a tree and watch everyone rush around about me.
Now we have to pay rights to those people. From the world of faith, family, and fandom, in no particular order, geek out, y'all.
Nocturnal shadows, he would wait at the top of his game. Poor souls in his sights never saw the light of day. 'Cause he's Timmy, yeah. He's Timmy, yeah, yeah, yeah. Very brutal, but too casual. Near invisible, the deadliest marsupial. He's Timmy, yeah. He's Timmy, yeah, yeah, yeah. A fearless mercenary, a ruthless gun for hire. Small, dark, and hairy, this mammal never tires. As a target, you should be wary. He's Timmy, yeah. He's Timmy, yeah, yeah. He's Timmy, Timmy the Combat Wombat.